Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome to the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable. I'm Jeff Dufour, editor-in-chief of the National Journal, sitting in for Bill, who was off studying in Europe. Here in Washington, D.C., it's about 8:30 in the morning on Friday, April 19th, and it is a fluid situation here. Even among the lofty standards of 2024, this was an insane week in Washington. The Senate dismissed the first impeachment of a cabinet secretary in more than a century. The foreign policy establishment is trying to manage further escalation in the Mideast. The House may have hit rock bottom in the dysfunction department, but maybe, just maybe, it's bouncing back up enough to pass aid to Ukraine. Oh, and for the first time in American history, an ex-president is going on trial for criminal charges. Here to help us sort it all out are three top Washington reporters, all of whom, I am proud to say, are making their debut on the Reporters Roundtable. We have Minnie Raker, politics reporter for the Daily Beast and my former colleague at National Journal. Hello, Minnie.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Of course. We have Aaron Covey, U.S. House analyst for the Cook Political Report and also my former colleague. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for having me on.
Yes. And we have Maeve Sheehy, congressional reporter for Bloomberg Government. She is not my former colleague, but I won't hold it against her. And I will say that there is plenty of time. One day, maybe she will be.
Hey, Jeff, thanks for having me.
Maeve, I actually want to start with you because there is so much to unpack from Congress this week, especially in the House. I was hoping that, as I said, this is such a fluid situation that first off, you could just kind of level set for us and tell us what happened and exactly where things stand with regard to the supplemental bills for Ukraine and Israel as we sit here on Friday morning.
Yeah, so late last night, the Rules Committee, which kind of decides if a bill can come onto the floor, finally passed a rule for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and then some other bills like a partial TikTok ban, which is interesting. And that means that we're on track this weekend to have those get passed unless something really blows up on the floor, which obviously is always a possibility. But they were able to get these moved forward because Democrats were on board. And that kind of brings Mike Johnson into this weird coalition government situation that a lot of people on the right of his party are not happy about. You'll remember that that's why Kevin McCarthy ended up losing his job. So going forward, after we get these supplementals passed, the big question will be, can Mike Johnson keep his speakership or is he going to follow the same fate as McCarthy did last fall?
As you say, it's been quite a whirlwind week for Mike Johnson. Let's listen to a bit of what Mike Johnson had to say.
Why are you willing to risk losing your job over this Ukraine funding?
My philosophy is you do the right thing and you let the chips fall where they may. If I operated out of fear over a motion to vacate, I would never be able to do my job. History judges us for what we do. This is a critical time right now. I'm doing here what I believe to be the right thing. Providing lethal aid to Ukraine right now is critically important. I really do. I really do believe the intel. I think that Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if he were allowed. I think he might go to the Balkans next. To put it bluntly, I would rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys. This is not a game. It's not a joke. We can't play politics with this. We have to do the right thing. And I'm willing to take personal risk for that because we have to do the right thing and history will judge us.
Maeve, this sounds sensible and reasonable, but this also does not sound like the same Mike Johnson from a month ago. What do you think changed here? And is his job safe? Does he have enough cover from Democrats if there's a motion to vacate?
So the thing about Mike Johnson being speaker is that before October, most people didn't know his name. So we don't totally know who he is. And these past 6 months have been critical in him trying to show people what he wants his speakership to mean. And this week, it's probably he's decided this is probably going to be the most consequential thing he can get done is Ukraine aid and Israel aid. So he's trying to make a name for himself. And clearly he wants to be known as somebody who got this foreign aid out in a tough time for Ukraine. But The question about whether his speakership is safe, definitely not. There are some Democrats who have said that they'd be willing to help him, like they didn't for McCarthy. But overall, most people are keeping their powder dry, and Democratic leaders don't want any sort of commitment until after this Ukraine aid is passed and after the motion to vacate vote is triggered. Basically, if they show that they're going to cover him too early, then they don't have as much leverage there. So it makes sense that they would want to hold off on commenting publicly on that. But there is always a chance that Mike Johnson could follow the same fate as McCarthy, even though more Democrats are willing to trust him and they don't have the same sort of issues that they had with McCarthy.
They already got four Democrats on the Rules Committee to vote for the rule last night, which already is highly unusual that Democrats would help out a Republican speaker on their rule vote.
Yeah, that has never happened in modern history as far as I know. So that was huge.
Aaron, let me get you in here. Obviously, the final votes haven't been taken yet. That's going to happen tomorrow. But it feels like this chapter of the 118th Congress could be titled maybe Revenge of the Normie Republicans. Let's listen to what, just to pick one member out, let's listen to what Dan Crenshaw had to say this week.
They want Russia to win so badly that they want to oust the speaker over it. I think they want to be in the minority, too.
That's a pretty remarkable statement. And this comes after two Republican committee chairs, Mike McCall and Mike Turner, agreed last week that a lot of their colleagues repeat Russian propaganda, even on the House floor. So my question is, has a critical mass of this conference finally just said enough? They realize maybe that they don't have a 50-seat majority. They have a 2-seat majority.
Well, I think a lot of this is coming down to the realities of an election year and the fact that if these folks, these 17 Republicans who are in Biden districts are going to win re-election, they're going to need to be able to tell their constituents that they have been able to get things done despite the chaos that we've seen in Congress. And I think, you know, I've been really curious how much the chaos itself is going to play a role in Democratic messaging against these Republicans in swing seats. I think it will. I don't know if it's going to be like the defining message, but I think it's going to be a part of the message, certainly. And I think these Republicans are eager to show that they can get things done and that they can distance themselves as much from the Chip Roys and the Masseys and the Gates of their party as much as possible. So I think a lot of it is just the reality of an election year coming closer.
I know you spend all day tracking a lot of these numbers. Is there any evidence yet that all this turmoil and dysfunction could hurt House Republicans at the ballot box this year? For instance, is there any movement in the generic ballot or in key races that you've seen?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there has been a little bit of tightening in some of the polling in House districts I've seen. So things are looking a little bit better for Democrats. I think last year there was a lot of polling that was coming out, particularly on the Republican side, that looked really good for them, surprisingly good for them. And I think most folks expected it would tighten anyway. But yeah, I think control of the House remains a toss-up. Democrats certainly have some momentum on their side right now, but they would have to win just some quick math. About 2/3 of the races in our toss-up column for them to take back the majority, and Republicans would need to win about a little less than half of those races to retain their majority. So, you know, even as things are tightening, it's tightening in the way that we're anticipating. It's not like we're seeing any dramatic shifts in the environment.
And there's about, what, 20, 25 true toss-up House races?
Yeah, currently 22. It's kind of in that 20 to 25 range at all times.
Yeah. And just to give a couple examples, Washington Post reported this morning that Mike Lawler and Anthony Disposito, two of the most vulnerable House Republicans in New York, are calling on Johnson to kick Chip Roy, Ralph Norman, and Thomas Massie off of the Rules Committee, saying that they're just contributing to this dysfunction. So I'm guessing that we could see a little bit more of that, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Minnie, I don't want to leave you out of this, and I don't want to leave the Senate out of this either. After waiting weeks to do so, the House impeachment managers finally walked the articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary, Alejandro Mayorkas, over to the Senate, at which point the Senate voted that the whole thing was unconstitutional anyway and dismissed the charges in about 2 hours. Let's listen to Senate President Pro Tem Patty Murray, who presided over this all.
On this vote, the yeas are 51, the nays are 48. One senator responded present. The point of order is well taken, and the article falls.
Minnie, was there ever a point to any of this? Did James Comer and Jim Jordan, who pushed all this in the House, get anything out of this exercise?
Well, yeah, I think the point of this was always political. I think, you know, we saw experts mostly say that there weren't any real ethical reasons to go forward with this impeachment. And we saw Democrats kind of jump on that, say, you know, Republicans have policy disagreements with Mayorkas, and that's why they wanted to remove him from office, but that he did not actually do anything, you know, legally questionable. But now Republicans can point to this and say that Democrats do not want to crack down on the border, which I don't think is an accurate framing, but it's something that they can use as a political maneuver. And the reason they're going to do this is that immigration is, and border security is one of the strongest issues for Republicans. We see and hear that voters are concerned about this, that they trust Republicans more on the issue. So any evidence Republicans can point to that the Democrats are soft, they feel is going to benefit them in November.
Yeah, and I'll note that Mayorkas has been popping up in campaign ads from Republicans for a while. So, you know, they need a boogeyman. They don't have Pelosi anymore. They still have Biden. But this was definitely politically motivated from the beginning and I think was never going to be an actual possibility.
Let me ask all three of you then. Back to Chip Roy, I heard him say this week that he couldn't believe that we're back to potentially voting for aid to Ukraine and Israel without securing the border on top of it, at which point any neutral observer has to say, well, you've had for weeks or months a Senate bill that does deal with the border that you refused to vote for. Is this more valuable as a political bargaining chip than as an actual piece of policy?
I would hop in to say that a lot of times Republicans, when they say that they're not okay with the Senate bill, it's because they want H.R. 2, which is their very specific build the wall, Republican-only border bill. And the fact that that's the only thing that they'll settle for means that there's not really any sort of negotiation to be had, because if anything's less than H.R. 2, they're not willing to accept it. So I would say it's definitely more of a political messaging point than it is an actual thing to bargain with.
We had some big foreign policy news last night, too. Israel retaliated against Iran after Iran's 300 missile and drone barrage last weekend. Israel hit an airfield last night, Thursday night. The House did pass a slew of anti-Iran bills this week, Maeve. Will any of those or any action by Congress make a difference here, apart from just the billions that they want to send to Israel?
So the messaging bills are just that, messaging. The real action that's going to happen this week is because of the Israel, Ukraine, Taiwan, other bill. But these bills that are being put on the floor by GOP leadership in response to Iran, they're basically just to put them on the record about their opposition to Iran. So it's less of a actual policy proposal, and it's more of them just saying where they are.
Aaron, the White House slapped some new sanctions on Iran itself. Our old colleague George Condon wrote a piece last night about whether foreign policy would actually make a difference in this election. Ever since the Cold War ended, it's been way at the back burner in every presidential election, with the exception maybe of after the second Iraq War, voters punished the GOP for launching that war and being behind it. Are you seeing any evidence that voters could care about foreign policy this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly evidence that voters care a lot about it right now. Whether or not that's going to be a top issue in the general election, it's still to be seen. But, you know, I think it's certainly it's adding to the contributing factors that are dampening Democratic base turnout for Biden right now, or enthusiasm for Biden right now. And we saw that obviously in the uncommitted vote in places like Michigan and Minnesota earlier in the primary. And I think it's difficult to say whether these votes, how much of these votes are just protest votes and these people are going to come home to Biden in November, how much of it reflects actual frustration and folks who are not going to vote at all for the president or might even vote for Trump. I think the idea that a lot of these folks are going to vote for Trump and actually switch parties is pretty unrealistic. But I do think that there are serious issues with enthusiasm that Biden is dealing with right now. And it's not just this issue. It's also just frustration with inaction on cost of living issues, student loans, even like abortion rights to a certain extent. And so I think it's a factor. I think it's still not going to be a number one factor, maybe in the way that the Iraq war was in the Bush administration.
Minnie, I want to get you in here because you've done a lot of reporting on the Democratic base and progressive activism. Do you think Iran's attack on Israel and now the flip-flop, Israel's retaliation, does this change the political calculus at all? Because with Israel being attacked itself now, does Israel look more sympathetic, perhaps?
I don't know about that. I think it's still a little too early to say exactly what's going to happen. We're seeing both countries kind of minimize the latest attack. And we saw Biden this week, you know, urging Israel not to respond. So I think, you know, Biden's goal is to, you know, stay out of this as much as he possibly can, because I think Democrats can see, like Aaron talked about, that the continuing focus on the conflict abroad is definitely dampening support with his base. I think a lot of the, you know, a lot of the young people and the progressives who are turned off by his support for Israel are not going to be swayed right now, and, you know, may even be concerned about increasing American involvement in the wars abroad. I would say it's still a little early to say, but my bet would be it's not going to change much.
I would just point out also for anyone who is particularly concerned about the youth vote this year, Harvard just released a poll yesterday that showed among likely voters, the under 30 vote was still trending 56-37 Biden-Trump, which is perhaps it's an outlier because a lot of polls have been closer than that. But I think that's more in line of where we would expect the youth vote to be, given historical trends and where we might see it by the time the fall rolls around. Lots more to talk about on the second half, including the first Trump criminal trial and Biden getting an endorsement from the Kennedy clan, which we will get to after a short break on the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable. I'm Jeff Dufour, sitting in for Bill, along with Aaron Covey, Maeve Sheehy, and Minnie Raker.
And today's podcast brought to you by the American Federation of Government Employees, or the AFGE. They're the largest federal employees union, over 750,000 strong, under the leadership of President Everett Kelly, and they represent the workers, men and women, in every federal agency across the nation, working 24/7 to serve us, no matter who's in the White House, no matter who's in the Congress. They do the job every day. We're grateful for their good work and grateful for their longtime support of the Bill Press Pod. Check out their website at afge.org.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
We are back on the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable. I'm Jeff Dufour from National Journal, sitting in for Bill, along with Maeve Sheehy from Government, Minnie Raker from the Daily Beast, and Aaron Covey from the Cook Political Report. Minnie, we saw a bit of history this week with the first criminal trial of a former U.S. president. Let's listen to a firsthand report from the defendant himself.
It's a shame. It's a shame. And I'm sitting here for days now, from morning till night, in that freezing room, freezing. Everybody was freezing in there. And it's very unfair, very bad thing. Very bad thing. The whole world is watching this hoax.
Minnie, Trump is cold. Are there any other takeaways that you would like to that you would like to give us? Is this trial everything you hoped it would be?
Oh man, you know, I think during the primary, I talked to so many Republican voters who said, you know, they would be unfazed by Trump's criminal proceedings. Certainly, many members of Congress on his side of the aisle have suggested they don't care much about it. And Donald Trump himself has suggested, you know, his, as he would see it, persecution is representative of persecution of the millions of Americans who think like him. That's his framing. But I think my take so far is that this is not a positive for him, and it may in fact be a slight negative. I think the headlines we've seen coming out of the trial so far include that Trump is falling asleep, which is not great given his attacks on President Biden. And one of his main points of strength is kind of projecting an energy that Biden does not. I think it's keeping him off of the campaign trail and in New York, so he can't have his you know, beloved rallies at the same pace that he might have in the past. So, you know, while I would say that people who are really cemented in their opinion of Trump, they're either going to vote for him or against him already. If there's some people in the middle who are just, you know, looking for a politician who's looking out for them, I don't think the trial is doing him any favors.
No, he's basically got Wednesdays, which the trial will be off, and the weekends. And other than that, he's required to be in the room Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. He's only got on his campaign website two events scheduled at the moment for the foreseeable future. Maeve, it's almost cliche to ask this, but agree or disagree, will this trial move the needle at all, so to speak?
Well, if you're looking at the House, Trump has already shown that he has a ton of influence within House Republicans. He's been tweeting about the FISA bill, which was a couple weeks ago with spy powers. He's been tweeting about Ukraine aid, and people are really standing by his side. So I wouldn't say that the trial has changed anything so far, and I wouldn't expect it to necessarily in the future with the party. He's kind of the de facto leader there in the House, whereas Mike Johnson hasn't had the same level of effect.
Aaron, I know you're constantly tracking campaign fundraising numbers, and this week, the first quarter reports came in. Were there any big takeaways or anything that surprised you about the Q1 fundraising numbers?
Not any huge surprises. Fundraising has been a little low this cycle in general, particularly on the Democratic side, and we've seen that both with challengers and incumbents and Democratic organizations that typically spend in primaries. They've all kind of been struggling a bit for the past year. But, you know, I think that things are kind of evening out now at this point. The one surprise, or maybe surprise, that I did see was that just Johnson's political operation is doing significantly worse than McCarthy's was at this point last year and at this point in the 2022 cycle, which, you know, isn't everything, but will have an impact for a lot of these challenger candidates who rely on like having support from the party infrastructure in order to be able to rack in those big numbers. So we saw Johnson's joint fundraising committee raised about a little less than a third of what McCarthy's did in Q1 of 2023, which I thought was significant. And you also saw House Democrats' main super PAC, the House Majority PAC, and its advocacy group outraised their Republican counterparts at the Congressional Leadership Fund this quarter, which does not happen. I think might have set a record. And so there's been some interesting movements there. I think, you know, the a lot of Democrats' strongest fundraisers are currently running for Senate or for governor, which is a huge loss for them. So, you know, the Abigail Spanbergers, the Alyssa Slotkins, the Katie Porters, obviously she's not running anymore. Those have been their top fundraisers for the past several cycles now, and now they're not running for their House seats. So that is certainly a loss. But I think that Democrats, I would say, are feeling decent in general about how their incumbents are doing at the House level. Certainly at the Senate level, they're pulling in massive numbers.
Finally, in Philadelphia this week, President Biden got the endorsement of about 15 members of the Kennedy family. Let's listen briefly to Kerry Kennedy.
This campaign is not about Bobby. This campaign is about Trump versus Biden. And what we need to do today is focus on Biden winning. A vote for anyone else is a vote for Trump.
I'm just going to throw this to the group. Does anyone want to weigh in on that? Is this a sign that the Biden campaign really takes seriously the threat that RFK Jr. potentially poses?
I would say for sure. And I think we've seen evidence of that for quite a while. You know, we have RFK polling, you know, sometimes he's polling at like 2%, but sometimes he's polling as high as 11%.
Yeah, and the polls are really all over the place on this.
Yeah, but even that 2% can be the deciding factor in an election that's as likely, you know, to be as close as this one is. And we've seen, you know, there's a new kind of Biden ally backed super PAC just focused on combating third party candidates. I think Democrats have known for a long while that, you know, they're probably not going to lose those young kind of disengaged voters we were talking about. They're probably not losing those voters to Trump. They're either losing those voters to apathy, to, you know, not wanting to go out and actually cast a ballot for Biden, or they're losing those voters to a third party. You know, as we've seen, people kind of turn away from partisan politics more than ever before, I would say. There's a real threat that some of the Democrats base goes to someone like RFK, especially, you know, with the Kennedy name. So I think the Biden campaign is kind of very aware of that and trying to get started on doing something about it.
Erin, Maeve, any thoughts on the younger Kennedy?
No, I mean, I agree with many. This is definitely a sign from the Biden campaign that they're taking it seriously. And I think they've known for a while that this would be necessary. You know, I think the polling's all over the place. Third party candidates tend to poll higher until voters actually get closer to the election and realize that they need to make a choice. So I think I would be surprised if we saw RFK's numbers go up or stay at the same level that they're at right now. But, you know, in such a close election, it's going to make these third party candidates make a huge difference in the swing states that we're watching. So it's definitely a serious threat that I think the Biden campaign is very aware of and is taking quite seriously.
Well, thanks all. Great conversation today with Erin Covey, Maeve Sheehy, and Minnie Raker. Now it's time for Bill's favorite moment of the show, your favorite story of the week. Something that made you go, whoa, made you laugh, or something that you just wanted to share. Minnie, want to get us started with your favorite story of the week?
Yeah, for sure. So a really interesting story, I thought, came out this week was from the new news outlet Notice. And it was about how some Democrats have thought about addressing the Comstock Act with legislation. And this is the law that some Trump allies have suggested if Trump becomes president next year, he might use to crack down abortion access nationwide by preventing the mailing of abortion drugs throughout the states. Now, some Democrats have wanted to call attention to this, repeal it now before Trump might even have that option. But we've got some abortion rights groups, according to this report, telling them not to do that because it might affect current legal battles. I thought this was really interesting because, you know, this is the centerpiece issue that I would say Democrats would like to run on. They know it's, you know, where public opinion is on their side, and many members of Congress probably want to, you know, point that out and think that will be a factor in their campaigns this year. And, you know, it's still an opportunity if Democrats like actually want to take action on this. This may be their best opportunity now, but they're being kind of hamstrung by their own allies. I thought that was a really interesting dynamic.
Thanks, Minnie. Maeve, favorite story of the week?
Yeah, so I think a couple of news outlets wrote about this, most recently Roll Call and Axios. But even though House legislative procedure can seem kind of boring, it was pretty interesting this week because members were using the whole amendment process to basically throw shade at each other. So Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is in the news a lot these days for her threat to oust Johnson, she put an amendment on the Ukraine funding package that would require all members of Congress who vote in favor to conscript in the Ukrainian military, which is obviously not going to pass, but it's kind of just her way of messaging. She also had one about using space lasers on the southern border. That was for a different funding bill. One about redirecting the funds from Ukraine to the attorney general for the, quote, mass deportations of illegals. So just like some really interesting out there amendments. And then on the other side, Jared Moskowitz, who's a Democrat who's worked across the aisle and is not a fan of Greens, he put in an amendment that would rename Marjorie Taylor Greene's office as the Neville Chamberlain Room, and another that would make her Vladimir Putin's special envoy to the United States Congress. So if you look at the Rules Committee website, it's usually not the most interesting thing in the world, but this week it was pretty interesting as members used those amendments to kind of throw shade at each other and attack each other.
Love it. Aaron, favorite story of the week?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this and I was in a car driving by myself for a long time this week, which usually doesn't happen. I don't own a car, but the car I was driving did not have a functioning aux cord. And so I was just like listening to the local NPR stations.
Terrestrial radio. Wow.
I know. Yeah. Vintage. And I used to work at NPR. So I should listen more than I actually do. I was listening to this Reveal podcast, which I had heard of, but hadn't really listened to intentionally before. And they had aired this really interesting episode talking to a woman who was pregnant in Gaza for like the past 6 months. And it was just fascinating, gripping. I like stayed in my car in the driveway afterward, like had the classic driveway moment to like finish listening to it. So I would recommend listening to that, definitely. It should be on all the usual podcast platforms as well.
Thank you. My favorite story of the week reminded everyone that while Trump is subject to his own bizarre flights of rhetorical fancy, Biden is not quite immune from it either. In making a speech in Pennsylvania, Joe Biden asserted twice that his uncle, who served in World War II, may have been eaten by cannibals. Speaking first at the Scranton War Memorial, he said his uncle flew single-engine planes, reconnaissance flights over New Guinea. He had volunteered because someone couldn't make it. He got shot down in an area where there were a lot of cannibals in New Guinea at the time. Not to be outdone, he then repeated the story later on in Pittsburgh, saying he got shot down in New Guinea and they never found the body because there used to be lots of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea. This, of course, inspired several fact checks by media organizations who pulled military records and whatnot of his uncle, and concluded that in fact his uncle probably was not eaten by cannibals. That's a wrap for this edition of the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable. We'll end with cannibals. Our thanks to you for taking time out from listening to the new Taylor Swift album and listening to Maeve Sheehy, congressional reporter for Bloomberg Government, Minnie Raker, politics reporter for The Daily Beast, and Aaron Covey, U.S. House analyst for the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter. I'm Jeff Dufour, editor-in-chief of National Journal, sitting in for Bill. But Bill did leave us a new podcast for next Tuesday with presidential historian Douglas Brinkley, part three of a four-part series on what former presidents can teach us about this election and these candidates. Until then, thanks for listening to the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable.